In this episode, we welcome back Dr. Paul Tees to explore the importance of effective staff consultation and its connection to staff wellbeing. Stay tuned. Welcome to Well-Led Schools with Adrienne Hornby. On this podcast, we talk about all things staff wellbeing, school culture, and leadership. Join me for incredible and rich conversations with a range of experts who will give you tips, tricks, and inspiration to best support the well-being of the staff in your school and yourself. I'm your host, Adrienne Hornby, a health and well-being consultant and former school leader. I partner with schools across Australia to tailor and embed staff well-being action plans aimed at addressing staff burnout and building positive working environments. This episode is brought to you by our signature Well-Led Schools Partnerships, a 12-month program that brings leaders and staff together to create a shared vision for their school and empowers them to create an action plan that leads to needle-moving changes in school culture and morale. Doors to our partnerships open only once per term. Stay updated on program openings and sign up for the waitlist at adriennehornby.com.au/school-partnerships. Welcome to the Well-Led Schools podcast, where we explore the interplay and connection between educational leadership and wellbeing in schools. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of welcoming back a familiar voice, Dr. Paul Tees. Paul previously joined us this season to discuss the foundations of effective educational leadership. Today, he is going to be sharing his insights on a crucial aspect of leadership, consulting with staff. With over four decades in the educational leadership space, including 24 years as a principal, Paul brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to our discussion. Consulting with staff is essential for building trust, fostering collaboration, and enhancing engagement within a school community. When leaders effectively consult with their staff, they not only improve job satisfaction and strengthen relationships, but also create a more inclusive and dynamic school culture. In this episode, Paul will share how his leadership has evolved, strategies for managing resistant staff, and the key benefits of involving staff in ongoing conversations. We'll also explore common mistakes that leaders can make when consulting, the difference between consultation, collaboration, and cooperation, and expert strategies for enhancing your consultative practices. Whether you're an experienced leader or just starting out, this episode really is packed with valuable insights to help you foster a supportive and engaged school and staff climate. Let's dive in. Thank you so much, Dr. Paul, for joining me again. I feel really honored to have you as a guest a second time around to soak up all of the wisdom and advice.
Well, thank you, Adrienne, for giving me the opportunity to join you again. Really enjoyed our last podcast, and I know this is going to be a really enjoyable part of my day. So thank you.
Oh, that's very kind. Paul, how has your leadership evolved since your first appointment as a school leader?
Yes. Look, I think there's been a tremendous evolution in my approach to leadership. My first early appointment as a principal, I was pretty focused on establishing authority and ensuring compliance with rules and standards and expectations and levels of accountability. But over time, I've realized the importance of relationships, building relationships, and fostering a collaborative environment. One of the key shifts for me is becoming more attuned to the emotional and social dynamics of leadership, understanding and addressing the emotional needs of staff and students. It became a priority in the latter part of my principal, recognizing that emotional well-being is crucial for effective learning and for workplace environments. I think I got better at resilience and adaptability. I had to, especially in the face of challenges like the global pandemic. And I think as a leader, being flexible and ready to pivot strategies when necessary has been crucial for navigating uncertainties effectively. Gone are the days of having a goal or an objective or a plan and locking it in and expect to achieve it, you know, as you had conceptualized it. So in summary, I think I've moved from a focus on control and compliance to one that values empowerment, emotional intelligence, continuous learning, and adaptability. And all that's aimed at fostering a really positive and progressive school culture.
I like that whole notion of moving from a place of control and compliance. And listen, I've never been a principal, but I've worked with lots of principals in my career as a teacher and a leader, and then now in the consulting space. And you know, one of the things we talk about in being a really authentic leader is that whole internalized moral perspective. So it's, you know, I think it's very normal for us to want to be following the rules and ensuring we're doing things in alignment with the powers that be in how we run our school. But in time, we realize that by doing that, we lose the trust and the connection with the people in our school who we're meant to be leading and advocating for. So sort of moving into that place of connecting with them and what it is that they need is really imperative. Did you, in terms of that happening in schools and the leaders that you're working with, do you hear a lot about that, of the pressure that comes from our departments or for our education officers, and how tricky it is to cross over from that leader who does what they're told and follows along to that leader then who changes into pushing back a little on that in order to be able to support their people a bit more?
Look, I think in order for your school environment to thrive, you've got to be the latter. You have to push back. But I've noticed this over my career, which, you know, say best part spends three decades of principalship or executive leadership in a fairly senior level. The regimes, the state-based curriculum authorities have intensified the control over schools, school curricula and over teachers in that journey, significantly so. Moving from, you know, when I started as a principal to frameworks and overviews and acceptance that, you know, principals could be trusted, school curriculum leaders could be trusted, and teachers with good intent did the right thing, to the regime we have now where it's heavily prescribed curriculum, there's inspections, you know, NESA don't want to call them that, but that's what they are in New South Wales. So the compliance and the accountability and the very rigid frameworks with which principals and schools have to work now is vastly different. So it takes some courage as a principal to push back. You know, you are the gatekeeper for your teachers, ensuring that what comes through the gate to the teacher interface is of real high quality and adds value to the teaching and learning dynamic. So it is hard for principals to push back, particularly if you work in systems or you work in public education, where there is high levels of accountability for the system-wide performance. Whereas in an independent school, say, for example, where I worked all my life, you're accountable to your school community, you know, your board and your school community and your community of teachers. And that was a much, much more liberal way of working than to be accountable to a central system. So, you know, I think it is a problem, and you make a very good point. It is stifling creativity. It's sucking the marrow out of teachers, you know, with this very strict compliance regime that exists. And those people who work in the central offices, Bates and other places, will say it's not like that, you know. But from where they work in their office, it's not. Mm. But the experience on the ground for teachers and students and that is vastly different.
Yeah, and something that comes to mind as you're talking then is that I think a lot of, I think majority, if not all, leaders have, well, senior leaders have really good intentions. And I think a lot of the time they end up in this mindset where they just want to get things done. Mm. So they push forward with things and they push past, that means consultation or getting that feedback, acting on it, feeding it back up, because of the pressures that of course we've just talked about that come down. But I do think that there's this element. I work with so many leaders who are actually just trying to push things over the line and get it done. And they think that they're helping their staff in terms of just making a decision and moving forward with it, or not asking for that input and consultation and feedback from their community, because that will delay the process and they just want to take that off staff's plate. But then we end up in this complex situation then where members of our community or stakeholders feel like they don't have that buy-in or that involvement in that overarching process, which then causes other challenges down the line.
I have to agree with you. And there's not much I can add to that. But Adrian, you would have experienced this in your teaching. Teachers are spending more time documenting learning and keeping records about learning than they are in the business of teaching and learning with children. You know, it's gone. It's the pendulum has swung far too far to the right or left, depending upon which view you have. But that's a reality for teachers. Rather than spending the time with children and learners and in the preparation of rich lessons, they are ground down with the documentation and record keeping and the compliance, you know, documenting lessons and what was learned, as opposed to actually the fun of teaching kids.
What's been one of your biggest challenges as a leader, and how did you overcome it and grow? You know, you talked a lot about that. You sort of moved from a place, I guess, around sort of the rules and the administrative side of things to a different level of leadership. So it might sort of fall under that. But, yeah, what do you think's been one of those biggest challenges in your career?
This is a really good question. And my answer might seem a little bit at odds with what I was just saying. but look, one of the more nuanced challenges that I've faced has been managing staff, particularly teachers, who are resistant to feedback and hesitant about personal and professional growth. Mm-hmm. Look, the resistance can stem from various factors: fear of change, past negative experiences, or a lack of confidence in their abilities, or, as we were talking about before, workload. It's just something else that, you know, in terms of accountability or record keeping, they have to engage in. So to address that, I learned the key is to foster a culture of trust and safety. You know, it's crucial for staff to feel that feedback is not punitive, but it's a tool for development and support. And to achieve that, I began my modelling the behaviour I expected from others. I openly sought feedback on my own performance, showing that vulnerability and a willingness to learn are strengths, not weaknesses. And additionally, that I personalised growth opportunities for the teachers. I recognise that one-size-fits-all approaches do not work for everyone. They don't work for school systems, they don't work for schools, and they don't work for teachers. So I worked with resistant staff to identify their specific interests and their barriers. We set customized or tailored, achievable goals that aligned with their personal aspirations and the broader objectives of our school. By doing that, I've seen a significant shift in attitudes toward feedback and growth. And by leading with empathy, providing clear and constructive feedback, and supporting the individual growth pathways of teachers, we were able to transform resistance into engagement and foster a more dynamic and adaptable team. So that's one of the things I noticed. In overcoming it was personal exertion, building trust and confidence, and assisting teachers with actionable plans that were not onerous, but they could see was actually going to make them a better teacher. Because teachers entered teaching for an ideological view. Yeah, they wanted to change children's lives and learning. So if you can link any of their growth and development to enhancing their performance or their how they operate, their craft of teaching, they'll be engaged. So that's it. Might have been a longer answer than you're expecting, Adrian, but that's one of the things that I found.
And it's, you know, that in itself is a big process. So I want to take you back to the first part of that, which is really working with the staff to, I guess, unpack that source of their frustration or some of that challenge. Because I think, again, as leaders, we're not doing this for a number of reasons. Maybe it's because we're afraid of what will come out of that conversation. Will it reflect poorly on us as leaders? Is it that we think we don't have the time to possibly be able to address that? But in that process of working with those more resistant staff, those ones who are really struggling with change, or who, you know, we refer to them as our blockers or our squeaky wheels, whatever it might be, and unpacking that, is that an initial time commitment of really seeking that input and the contextualization of where they're at in terms of their resistance?
Yeah, look, no, you've nailed it. There are two things in there. Time is the big factor. Time to actually invest as a leader in your staff to understand and know what they want and take them on a pathway. And the second is then creating time for the teacher to actually invest in themselves when it comes to their own growth and development. So it does take time. But what I try to do is to give ownership of the process to the teachers, enabling to set goals and objectives. I didn't want many. I wanted two or three for a year. Like, it wasn't 8 or 9, 10 bulleted points about what they would work on. So I try to give them ownership. And then my job was to make sure that their goals did fit within the broader school goals, school-wide goals. And generally that would happen. If I was clear about our goals, the school's goals, and I had a good vision for that, and I communicated that clearly and well, most of the teachers picked up on that and they internalized that from their own perspective. And so I didn't really have a big job to do in making sure they were selecting goals for themselves that, you know, would align with the broader school goals. So that overcame some resistance. And the second thing, just enabling them to show, or for me, supporting them so that their goals or otherwise would actually add to their growth and development. Because none of them objected if they could see that it was genuinely a growth. What they objected to was putting time into what seemed like an administrative exercise. We had to have these appraisals. We had to have these goals. And it seemed administrative. So they did the exercise, took lots of time, developed a document which sat on a shelf. And there was no revisiting of that. So, you know, teachers get really skeptical about jumping through hoops when there's no tangible benefit to them, but not so much them. They're thinking on behalf of their children and their students. Mm. So you had to overcome that. That was a big one to overcome to make sure it just wasn't an administrative exercise. And I think it becomes an administrative exercise in lots of systems and schools. We have to have this, therefore we'll do that. And it's like it's a one event in time exercise that's not sustaining. So, you know, there's also a lot of work to be done around sustaining the processes and the feedback and the support to ensure that, you know, what you agreed with the teacher actually is working. And so therefore check-ins, evaluation, agility, adjustments, making changes. And yet sometimes a teacher didn't get to a particular goal or objective, too aspirational in the beginning, just too big, it was never going to be achieved. And they come to you and they say, look, I can't get on, and just say, well, that's okay. Let's cross that one off the list. Let's cross that one off the list and see what else you've been doing. So part of it is to unshackle the regime, if you like, or the strident, you know, adherence to a set of rules and regulations. That's my opening remark about how my leadership has changed, you know. So there's a whole different ways of approaching the same endpoint, and you have to be prepared to be flexible depending upon the teacher that you're dealing with, or the leader that you're dealing with.
It comes back to this whole theme again around time, I think. And as leaders, we rush on or we push forward without investing in what seems quite burdensome in the beginning, really sort of fleshing this out with our staff. And, you know, it's leading into the topic of our conversation today around consultation. But if we push forward and ignore this really important part of the process, we just end up with a challenge in a different area that isn't related to time, and it's a bigger one, and it's a cultural challenge. And it, you know, hopefully today really communicates the value in that initial time investment in doing some of this work around establishing those foundations, around ascertaining what's actually going on, where we're at, and then connecting that to this ideal place of where we want to go, which is connected to our vision, and then the goal setting that sits under that for the whole school, for teams, for leaders, but for individual staff. So it's all connecting those ideas. And why I particularly invited you on today was because after our last episode where we chatted together, something that came out for me from the work that you do, both as a leader in your career and now supporting other leaders, was around consultation and authentic and really effective leadership. And one of the guiding principles of well-led schools, which is schools that lead with well-being in mind, is that they seek the input and consultation of all staff. And in my experience with schools, leaders perceive or interpret consultation differently, and therefore they enact it in very different ways.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, Paul, what's your definition or explanation of effective consultation with staff? Because there's consultation and then there's consultation that works.
Look, effective consultation with staff, especially within the context of well-led schools that, you know, in your work that prioritize well-being, it's a multifaceted process. I'm going to mention three pillars today. Effective consultation requires inclusivity. I'll develop that. The second is transparency. And the third is actionable outcomes. So let me briefly touch on each one of those. So it goes beyond merely collecting opinions. It involves a genuine and structured engagement with staff at all levels, ensuring that their voices are not only heard, but are also influential in decision making. That's the key. So first, as I said, effective consultation requires inclusivity. It's crucial that every staff member, regardless of their position or tenure, feels they have an accessible platform to contribute. This means actively reaching out to often underrepresented voices within the school, ensuring diverse perspectives are included. The second is transparency. For consultation to be effective, leaders must be clear about the scope of the decisions being made, the rationale behind seeking input, and how this input will influence the outcomes. Hopefully today we'll talk about consultation, collaboration, and cooperation, because I can touch on this a bit more there. But that clarity, it helps staff understand the importance of their contribution and fosters a deeper commitment to the consultation process. I believe effective consultation involves empathy and active listening, and it's important to approach these consultations with an open mind and a readiness to be influenced by what you hear. This sometimes, it can mean setting aside your own preconceptions and being prepared to make adjustments based on what you hear. And the final thing that I mentioned is consultation should culminate in actionable outcomes. Staff should be able to see a clear link between the input they provided and the actions taken. I can't stress this enough. It not only validates the process, but also reinforces the value of their engagement. So, can you establish a clear link between the input and the actions taken? As I said, consultation isn't about, you know, giving up the decision-making process. But if it's authentic, you know, there has to be visible what you have, you know, what staff have said to you and how that's impacted on the actions that you've taken. Very important process.
Yeah, and I like how you've tied it together in somewhat of a framework, even though we talk about all the frameworks that are going around, but to help us really understand how to consult and do it effectively. And coming back to this first pillar around inclusivity and the underrepresented was something that stood out to me there. So in schools, I think a lot of our consultation can be very teacher-centric because our teachers, of course, fill up the majority of the staff in our school. And we think that, particularly I'm thinking around a wellbeing approach or a cultural approach, you know, we think, oh, teachers are really stressed, we need to focus on those. But what I've found in a lot of my work with schools is that our admin, non-teaching and learning support staff can feel really missed in a lot of those discussions or the practices around consultation. And it's not in all schools, because some schools have a really strong culture of that all staff mentality. So I liked that mention there around ensuring that staff at all levels, their needs are met. and that accessible platform. So often we'll run consultations in staff meetings that, let's say, our non-teaching or admin or learning support staff aren't a part of. So then they don't get, you know, the seat at that decision-making table or at the consultation table, which is something that we really need to consider if we're going to be consulting with our staff, making sure that everybody at all levels is, they get to share their voice. Isn't it right, Paul? Mm.
Yeah. And look, I had a wonderful relationship at one of my schools with the head of maintenance and the head of the cleaning contractor. So we had an external cleaning contractor. And routinely, the three of us would walk around the school, going into all parts of the school, including bathrooms and so on. And while they would tell me what needed to be done, they would tell me where I needed to apply my elbow grease. There's no point asking a teacher about, the state or otherwise of bathrooms and how children are respecting the bathrooms, because, you know, teachers don't want to be drifting in and out of toilets, you know, let's face it. So I could accept that. So the best way for me to get the first-hand data around the hygiene in the school, and I mean hygiene in the very broadest conception of it, was to walk around routinely with these two key staff. They loved it because they could tell me what needed to be done. I would go away and action it, and they just felt so empowered to have a voice and to have a say. It worked miraculously. So it's a great point you raise. Consultation is more than talking to teachers. That's great in a welfare and pastoral and academic sense, but schools are much bigger than that. And so sometimes it's the educational assistants or the sporting coaches who are seeing the real behaviours of children that can give you some insights from a different perspective. So it's a great point you make.
Yeah.
It's a great point.
And I also then want to come back under inclusivity. So we've touched on the need or a bit of a reminder to ensure that we're speaking with staff at all levels, but this accessible platforms. So this is such a great term because it's highlighting that our consultation just doesn't have to happen in a meeting. And you've just talked about there, consultation with those key staff in terms of the maintenance team was in a walk and talk meeting. So consultation doesn't just have to be an after school meeting or an executive team meeting. It can be in a conversation. Can you unpack a little bit more around some really quick examples of different accessible platforms or ways to consult?
I can. And you're right. The problem with a meeting is it'll be the loudest voices that get heard. Yep. And those people who've got something genuine they want to say, they don't have the confidence to speak up in front. Like I'd had 150 staff in the hall, 90 of which are teachers. Could you imagine a non-teaching staff member who works in the sick bay area wanting to speak up in front of that audience? No way. Hmm. So I had other possible. I advocate this a lot is a survey. You can have a 10-item survey which gives you powerful feedback. Everyone can complete that. And, you know, you ask everyone to complete it because you value their input and what they've got to say. Really easy to do. Well constructed, rich data. The second is the sort of department inclusive forums, so or meetings. So if you wanted to talk to the business management team and get their feedback, meet with that team alone, you know, so you can engage with them and they can talk to you. And that works really well. But my favorite is the one-on-one interviews. Mm-hmm. I would bring over the cycle of the year, every member of the teaching and non-teaching staff to my office for a 20-minute conversation. Tell me three things that are going well that we must hang on to, three things that you would like me to put my energy and attention to. But everybody was involved in those meetings on a cycle. Mm. And so I gave the opportunity to everyone. And so, you know, but I think what happened was we created a culture where the people who worked in the school wanted to work there, you know, so they were invested. So the fact they wanted to work there, they had an interest in their workplace environment and the culture. So they were happy to talk to me about how that could be enhanced from their perspective. Often it was only a five-minute meeting. Oh, I love working here. You know, everything's going really well, that sort of thing. Other times I might say just one thing to you. You know, I wish we could change this. And they're off you go. So, yeah, I'm trying to keep it brief, but they're the three things that I used at different times, you know, for different reasons, but always involved everybody in those sessions. To do a whole staff of 100 or 200 or 50, that takes enormous skill from the principal as a facilitator to engage in effective consultation with those sorts of numbers. So you've got to use other means.
Yeah, and I'll expand on that further based on some experiences that I have with large schools now and speaking with the principals about, you know, the struggles of being able to consult beyond just a meeting. So, you know, I'm thinking of a school in particular that I'm working with where staff are really struggling in terms of they don't think that there's enough opportunities for consultation and decision making. And something that we have to break down really early is that that isn't just in a consultative committee or in a forum like what you talked about. You can do it in multiple different ways. As you've said there, survey, focus groups, these one-on-ones. But to build on that further, it doesn't always just have to be the principal who's consulting with the staff. It's connecting the dots between when you speak with your direct leader or your direct manager and you consult with them and they run something in a meeting or they speak with you one-on-one, what is then the process for feeding that back up to the principal, getting the feedback from that and then feeding it back down the line? Because consultation just isn't the sole responsibility of the principal. And you would have experienced this in your career. It's all leaders at all levels are consulting and should be consulting at all times. It's just how do we then bring this back to one key point and learn from that and therefore draw out of that the actions that we need to put in place or to change. So consultation really needs to be seen as something, you know, not always just formal, but also informal as well. And it's how we develop that process for bringing the ideas together.
Mm. And I've done this work with a couple of schools recently in my year-long programs. We talked about a communication audit. How does information flow in the organization? And it is terribly important that those conversations that teachers are having with their heads of faculty or heads of year, whatever that next layer of leadership is, bubble up to the principal.
Mm.
And so having a look at the communication flows both ways is very important. And you've just raised the bottom-up approach. Mm. I advocate for that. So when teachers are sitting around in their common room or otherwise talking about matters of school importance, and they're sharing that with middle leaders, what are they doing with that information? Well, they share it with their direct reports. Mm. And ultimately, when I sit around with the executive leaders in the cabinet room, we're getting all of this passed on. So a standing agenda item is feed up, feed down, right? So It's the same thing. When we finish our executive or cabinet meeting, we talk about communication of the decisions and what that looks like. So it's got to be very, very purposeful.
Yeah.
Communicating the decisions made at the executive level so everybody knows what we're thinking, why we're thinking that, and how it's a benefit. But then, you know, the teachers who are sitting around in the common room, they don't see it as providing feedback, but they're sharing things that matter to them. And how do I get the principal get that? I'm relying on the layers of leadership to feed up. So this is a great point. Do a communications audit around communication flows in your school and see if there's any blockages or constrictions or you know. But at the end of the day, just ask a teacher, you know, if you've had a good idea, what happened with it?
Mm.
And they'll say, oh, well, it didn't go anywhere because. All right. Well, that's enlightening. Let's do something about that. So, again, the message you're, you know, sharing with the listeners, Adrian, is that, you know, consultation can just be as beneficial as a good conversation, you know, with somebody that materializes into an outcome.
Mm, but that's it. We need to connect the dots to turn it into the outcome. And so a key takeaway of what you just said there is around scheduling in these meetings as a greater leadership team to bring all of this to the table, unpack it as a group, get that messaging consistent. And I think when, again, for the sake of time, we don't run those kinds of meetings, then our leaders at all levels don't understand the context, the perspective, how actually challenging it is to be able to put forward or act on an idea of staff. Like an example I had the other day was that staff want less meetings. And as a leadership team, they talked about how that wasn't feasible at all, and they actually had reduced lots of meetings, but the ones that are in place need to be there and we can't change the time for this reason. And it was so enlightening even for me to realize the complexity of how decisions are made. But if our leaders at all levels aren't privy to those conversations, just to see the real nitty-gritty, then they can often live in the same space as our staff, which is this idealistic this idealistic place where we can just cut meetings and you can all go home early without that full context. And they just buy into that messaging of the staff as well. Like, yeah, why do we have all of these meetings? Yeah. And then they're not advocating or a united front. So one big takeaway from that, what you said, is around scheduling this time to talk about that feed up and feed down and not pushing that off the to-do list, because again, this is where we end up with some of these cultural challenges.
And I just want to pick up on something. You said conversations, and I think it's a great point. You know, teachers are asking for less meetings, but they're not asking for less conversations. They're happy to have conversations. The problem with meetings is they're not about conversations or dialogue.
Yeah, admin-based.
You know, that's it.
They're boring.
That's a big thing. If you change the way, generally speaking, meetings are conducted and turn them into conversations, where there's genuine consultation and collaboration, all of a sudden the culture of communication and achievement, innovation in your school changes.
Yeah, and that's a big aha moment. And then that links into this transparency. With these conversations, it gives us more opportunities to be transparent, because we're having conversations and we're developing our perspective and our empathy and our open mind. I think my work in schools and just listening to diverse perspectives all the time has completely opened up my eyes, and we needed to be doing more of this in school. But I love that whole end point around these actionable outcomes and tying up that feedback loop. Like, we don't just bring all staff together and talk about things and nothing happens. We really need to close that up, saying, okay, from this conversation, we've had a few key themes that are quite repetitive, or that lots of staff are experiencing challenges in. So it sounds like we need to do X, Y, and Z, and this is our plan for doing that. As opposed to, I think many schools open up the floor for consultation. They feel like they're being transparent, but then there's no connection of that conversation to what then actually happens or our next steps.
Agreed. Follow up and act.
What do you think are the benefits of effective consultation for staff wellbeing and morale and school culture? I mean, we've unpacked a few of them, but
yeah, for sure.
What do you think are the key benefits? Why, you know, if leaders listening, why do they really need to prioritize effective consultation?
Yeah. Look, you probably know I could talk about these sort of things all day, but I've got three. I'll mention three. my dialogue doesn't generally go in threes, but today there's that thing. The first one is enhanced staff wellbeing. That would be the first, and I'll develop that. The second is improved morale. I'll develop that. And the third one is strengthened school culture. So they're the broad benefits. Effective consultation empowers staff by giving them a voice in decisions that affect them, their work, and their professional environment. So that empowerment can lead to greater job satisfaction, reduced feelings, you know, of helplessness or frustration, which are often significant stressors in the workplace. And strong well-being usually means that staff will stay and you don't have that turnover of staff. So, you know, when they're consulted, they feel more supported, and that sense of support can alleviate anxiety and stress, contributing to better mental health and overall well-being. And if that's intact, they do a great job in front of children and teaching. The second one's improved morale. You know, knowing that their opinions and feedback are valued and considered can significantly boost staff morale. The recognition fosters a positive workplace atmosphere where staff feel appreciated and respected. And, you know, with morale boosted by effective consultation, staff engagement typically increases, and engaged staff are more likely to be committed to the school's mission and put extra effort into their roles, leading to higher performance. And school culture, which I think trumps everything else, effective consultation builds trust between staff and leadership. And when decisions are made transparently and inputs from staff are visibly incorporated into outcomes, it reinforces trust and openness in the school culture. Consultation encourages a collaborative environment where staff feel they are part of a team working towards shared goals. And that can lead to stronger relationships and a more cohesive school community. So in wrapping this segment up, or this question, a culture that regularly consults to its staff is more likely to be innovative and adaptive, which is what we need to be in schools. Staff are more open to changes and new ideas when they are part of the conversation, which makes the school more dynamic and much better equipped to handle challenges and much better equipped to teach the current generation of child or teenager. So there are three key benefits that, you know, principals and school leaders should think about when it comes to effective consultation.
And what I like about all three of them was that they all link to improved student outcomes, growth, performance, and that of the school as well. And this is something I talk about a lot, that when we focus on just this really narrow focus of staff wellbeing alone, it doesn't actually get us the outcomes that we're looking for. We're looking at enhancing those other key influencing areas. So staff satisfaction, engagement, their feelings of tangible support, not just lip service. And then the element of the school-wide relationships, which you connected beautifully into all three of those points. Those things have been shown in the research to influence school outcomes, not just this kind of narrow focus on staff wellbeing alone. So consultation, a really strong, effective consultation process, influences staff wellbeing just in that really simple context of their mental health and their well-being, just their personal well-being, but in these other key really important areas which help us to dive a little bit deeper. So consultation really sits at the heart of so many of those influencing metrics if we do it really well. So it has so many benefits, and at the end of the day you tied it back to the outcomes for our students, which is one of the main reasons for why we do what we do, as well as to have a good sense of career well-being and loving being in a place. So that's so great. Now, Paul, what are some of the common mistakes, misinterpretations or oversights that leaders or schools can make when they consult with their people? So they think, right, we need to do more consultation, or we know we have to do it. What are some common mistakes you see, or maybe you've even done them in your time?
Well, I have all of these. Because, you know, when you're nearly three decades in principles, you're going to make plenty of mistakes. I'll break from the three mold to do four. How's that?
It sounds good.
So superficial consultation, poor communication of purpose and process, insufficient representation, which we have touched on before, and then the theme coming through in some of your commentary, which is lack of follow-up and feedback. So let's deal with superficial consultation. Engaging what I term checkbox consultation or tick box consultation, where leaders go through the motions of consulting without a genuine interest in the feedback. This can make the consultation seem disingenuous and can lead to cynicism amongst staff. And staff can spot it. They know. So staff may feel their input is undervalued, resulting in disengagement and a lack of trust in leadership. So if you engage in that tick box consultation, the next time you're out there consulting, they're not going to take you seriously. So you've created a serious problem in your communication culture. The next one is poor communication of purpose and process. So not clearly communicating the purpose, scope, and process of the consultation. So what is this consultation for? To help me make a decision? To give feedback, which I'll pass on to the board, you know, or to give me perspectives about parent attitudes to the school. So let's be clear about, you know, what the purpose, scope, and process is. That if you don't do that well, it can lead to misunderstandings about how the input will be used and what impact it might have. I mean, if you don't tell staff why you're consulting and what the outcome is, it's very hard for them to really help, isn't it, if they're not clear about it. So without clear communication, staff might not provide relevant or helpful feedback, or worse, they might feel misled if their expectations are not met. I'll touch quickly on insufficient representation, and we've both agreed that this is very important. Failing to involve a diverse cross-section of the school community. Often consultation efforts may have inadvertently favour certain groups, let's say teachers, over others, either through the timing of meetings, the format of feedback collection, or through biases. I know schools where, you know, Friday afternoon they put on staff drinks. Staff drinks start at 3:15, 3:30. Oh, that's convenient to the teachers, isn't it? But what about the support and operational staff who got to work till 4 or 4:30? It's just little things like that, you know, that's about in, when you think about inclusion, I mean, there's connotations of inclusion about underrepresented groups, but that's been inclusion. Mm. So if that happens, then it can lead to decisions that don't adequately reflect the needs and perspectives of everybody, which diminishes the effectiveness. And the final one is lack of follow-up and feedback. So, you know, not providing feedback or follow-up on the consultation process. So after collecting input, which is great, some leaders fail to close the loop by informing participants how their contributions have influenced decisions. It's a bit like staff reporting behavioural issues. You know, the conscientious teacher on playground duty reports from behaviours, never hear back what happened. Mm. You know, it doesn't incline them to want to be conscientious into the future. So if there's lack of follow-up and feedback, staff may feel that their participation was inconsequential, which can discourage future engagement and reduce the perceived integrity of the consultation process. So I've made each one of those mistakes at different times and for different reasons. Doesn't say it's a problem. It just means we have to renew our focus on the purposes of consultation and what we want to achieve each time we enter the process. So dust off our lessons learned. Think about the new process and how we're going to do it with our best foot forward.
Mm. All such great points. The one that stood out to me most was around that process and being clear on why mm-hmm. and how that information will be used, because there are so many things that happen across the school where we can seek consultation or feedback. I'm thinking more something that's department-led or that it's a direction from our education office that we just have to do. It's really out of our control. And we can seek feedback and consultation on how staff are faring with that, but that might not mean that we're able to change something. But maybe it's around the lines of we're seeking some feedback on how you're going, a bit of a check-in with you, mm. and using this information we'll send it back up to mm. you know, my director or the head of my area, or the department correct. Office at large, but being really clear and transparent on how there are some things that consultation can have a really quick and easy mm. influence on, and the stuff that we can sort of get going with, that low-hanging fruit. Mm. And then there's other elements that can't be changed, but we need to explain why. And that really important aspect of, okay, this is something that we probably can do, but it might take us time and processing, mm. plans, financing. But being really clear with if that information is being parked, and maybe a plan for when we'll revisit that as well, just to alleviate some of that anxiety or lack of clarity for our staff. Mm. We don't have to have all the answers that straight away, do we, Paul? But no. Just letting them know where all of that information's going and what our next steps are with it is something that we could it would really support some of our staff who are more cynical. As well.
No, this is a great point. And I just want to add emphasis to what you're saying. I don't think there's any decision that should be set in stone. Every decision ought to be up for review and evaluation. Mm. Ask the staff if it's a department decision. Ask the school principals, is it working? What could we do different? Part of the problem, though, is a lack of agile and flexible, adaptable leadership. Mm. You know, so I'm a big advocate of reviewing change. You know, so we've had this in place for 6 months. Is it working? Do we need to adapt it? Do we need some recalibration? There's not enough that happens at a systemic level in Australian schools. Take NAPLAN, for example. You know, I'm sorry, it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine, but you can't, I mean, anybody working in schools with children and learning would be hard-pressed to say NAPLAN is effective. NAPLAN does what it was intended to do. NAPLAN ought to survive. You know, I would challenge anybody. The purists might be right about the benefits of NAPLAN, but when is the last robust, rigorous review done of NAPLAN? And that, I think, is symptomatic of the way leaders and systems are operating in Australia. They don't do what you're saying. Okay, we made a decision. Let's see, is it working? Let's review it. Is there any recalibration we need? Can we do things differently? Should we change? Should we even scrap it? And, of course, a leader having made a decision and fought for it strongly isn't going to 6 months later say, I got that wrong. But there needs to be more of that because the decision to make at the time is only as good as the information, the data, and the consultation collaboration that you put into it. So we can make wrong decisions. And in schools, we must admit that and you know, to revisit it. And I think if we do that, we get a lot more people contributing in the first place. We get a lot more feedback. We get parents contributing ideas. So, yeah, I just really want to affirm the point you make about how we approach decisions and their success or effectiveness.
Well, I think with any change initiative, new plan, strategic direction, I always like to approach it through the lens of that sort of spiral of inquiry, which always brings us back to the checking in on whether it's working and scanning again, having a look at what's happening, how everyone's faring, how they're going, and what we need to do. Because one decision isn't going to, I really don't think, stand the test of time and keep going. I mean, I worked in a school with a great behaviour management process and approach, and it was wildly successful for a number of years, and then things begin to drop off. And is that motivation, buy-in, there's changing needs? You either need to refocus or you pivot a little bit. And something, just because it worked for a couple of years, doesn't mean that it will for years to come. So, we adopt new things, we get new ideas, we think more creatively. So it's always about, going around on that spiral of that process, but then also checking and changing direction.
Yeah. This is a classic case of leading. So the leader leading, and when they are part of the team and collaborating, it's a leader's job to know what's not working. It's a leader's job to know when processes are failing. It's a leader's job to spot that, but not the leader's job to solve it. That's when the leader steps into the collaboration phase and says, right, guys, I've identified a problem. Could be with the reporting system, whatever it might be. Now let's sit together and talk about how we can do this better than this collaboration. So the leader leads, but then they become part of the team in the collective solution. So you've just, talking about a wonderful paradigm of leadership there. Leaders need to know when things aren't working, but they don't have to own the solutions singularly, which many of them think they have to. And that then paralyzes them from acting because they go, I know it's not working, but I don't know what to do about it. Get your team together and come up with a collaborative solution what you can do.
Yeah. And that flows beautifully into my next question, which was, can you explain the difference between consultation, collaboration, and cooperation to the audience, and maybe even how they link in, how they all, all of them are required at different points?
Yeah. I was hoping you'd ask that one. consultation, simply involves seeking, as we've talked, seeking input and feedback from others before making a decision. So in this process, the decision-making authority typically rests with the leader or a specific group of decision-makers like your executive team. But they ask others for their opinions and perspectives. And the primary aim is to gather diverse insights, as you talked about, and information to inform decision-making. However, the final decisions may not necessarily reflect the consensus or suggestions of all those who are consulted. So that's consultation. Collaboration is a deeper and more integrated process. It involves working jointly with others to achieve a common goal, often implying a shared responsibility for the outcome. And so the leader steps out of leadership and into the team. So in collaboration then, power and decision making are more distributed amongst the participants. Each member's views are not just heard, but are integral to shaping the direction and execution of the project, say. So collaboration is then characterized by ongoing communication, mutual respect, and a higher level of engagement from all parties involved. Corporation's a bit harder to sort of be as succinct about, but I think it simply just refers to the act of working together willingly towards a shared goal, but in a less integrated manner than collaboration. Often you'll divide tasks up among the participants based on their skills or roles, and then each member contributes to the project in a somewhat independent but supportive manner. So they all know where they're going, but each person's working on their own based upon their unique skills. Cooperation is essential, particularly in schools, where there's different departments or groups need to align their efforts towards common school-wide objectives without necessarily being involved in joint decision-making or sharing responsibilities for the outcomes as closely as in collaboration. How'd I do?
Great. I love it. But something that popped out for me in there And I think too, as you talked about that cooperation, it is a tricky one to define. But you're right, it's the working together. And for me, it's the enacting our joint responsibilities for, and if I'm looking through that wellbeing and culture lens, which is obviously where I work, it's assuming that joint responsibility for staff wellbeing. So it's the leaders doing their bit to ensure that, and then the staff also doing their bit at a personal level with their staff, and then to enhance the whole school collective culture. So really it's the doing. Whereas I feel like there's so many opportunities at all three of these spaces for consultation and refinement. You know, the consultation's a clear one because we're obviously consulting, but as part of our collaborative efforts, we also get those opinions and perspectives and the inspiration to change that come out of that, as well as in the doing part. You know, we try and do things and things work and they don't. And this is where it links back to some of our earlier conversation, which is on how consultation should be happening at all times at all different levels. And we're picking up on things and hearing perspectives and getting new ideas and considering the multiple and very diverse views of all of the different people in our space, which then feeds into our decision-making and our consideration process. And this is where I think a really good leader is consulting just by leading at all times in their day. And it's something that, you know, we have to do as consultants. Obviously, we'll come in and run sessions and we listen to what people have to say, and then we hit barriers or roadblocks, or our schools do, our leaders and our staff, and from that we take from it what we think might need to happen and either coach or direct the schools that we're working with. So it's kind of this, to me, it's this full-on awareness and responsivity that was required as part of our duty as an effective leader at all times, isn't it?
It is. I couldn't agree more. Yes. And if there's not lots of conversations happening in your school, good, strong feedback loops, and, you know, you're not picking up on the static and the noise, start with consultation. Start with effective consultation. You know, it's probably unwise if there's not great conversations happening to jump into collaboration first. I think consultation, and you're right, that's a leadership function. A leadership function is to seek the input of others. So it's fundamental to good effective leadership is generating conversations where people are talking to you about their experience in your school. Absolutely.
And I think that all of these elements, like, they're woven into my partnership program. They're definitely probably woven into the work that you do with schools as well. But when we're plugging them in often and frequently and then reflecting on what comes out of them, this is enough to move the needle more than some of, you know, a lot of actions. It's just talking about it, building our perspective and seeing things through a different lens. I think it's the most underrated model or approach for improving staff wellbeing and culture is just to offer more opportunities for effective consultation, collaboration and cooperation, because it means subconscious shifts in the way that we do things. It doesn't have to be these really formalized approaches. It's just changing the way that we see things as a collective. What's your advice to any leaders or aspirants who are listening on enhancing their consultative practices within their teams or their school, even just your top suggested piece of advice?
All right. The first is cultivate a culture of openness. You know, foster in it, when we've said this, so I won't develop it. Foster an environment where all team members feel safe and valued. Would be the first. You know, when staff feel their input's genuinely welcomed and can lead to real changes, they're more likely to engage sincerely and constructively. I just want to confirm something I said earlier, ensure clarity and purpose. And I won't develop that because we've taken that up already, but understanding the boundaries and possibilities of their contributions help staff tailor their feedback more effectively, and that helps in terms of the consultation process. We've mentioned this also, but diversify feedback mechanisms. And we talked very early about using a variety of methods to gather feedback, not just the town hall meeting, because that recognises the fundamental thing about people. they have different communication preferences and abilities. So use surveys, focus groups, town hall meetings, informal one-on-ones, and so on. And the final one is follow up and act. Follow up and act. Always provide feedback on what you heard and how it will be used. Follow through on promises that you might have made during the consultation process. If suggestions can't be implemented, say why. Just explain why. Because if it can't be, there must be a reason why. So share that. And you're not asking people necessarily to understand or agree. You're just wanting to hear you about the why. And that demonstrates respect for the input provided, and it helps sustain engagement over time.
Yeah, and I'll add to that is that the more we talk with our staff about how difficult it is for something to come to fruition and really showing them how challenging that is, they then apply that same methodology to when things pop up in the future. So, you know, an instance might be around timetabling. We go, oh, we just can't do that. It's so complex, all of these things. And then later on when they have this grand idea or, you know, sometimes we see them as demands or a suggestion, they might think back to, the last time I raised this and the complexities were actually explained to me as to why this couldn't happen. And I didn't even get it, but I could just see how hard it was.
Yeah.
Maybe this is another one of those times where the plan is too idyllic and it just can't happen. And I honestly see the power in having some of these conversations where you might not get anywhere, but you're just like, this is so complex, because that is life. Even when you're trying to understand somebody else's decision-making or their preferences or why they think the way that they do, when you get to this point, we're like, I really don't get it. But we talk about that more. It's just it's empowering. There's an empowering sense in something that we're trying to make sense of is that we can't. And that's the nature of schools and leading big organizations is that sometimes it's just we can't do it, and we just have to accept that, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But by the same time, as a leader, don't be too quick to dismiss an idea or a suggestion.
Mm.
Sit down with that person and unpack it and see if there are some possibilities.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's about effective leadership. You know, if you think you're the smartest person in the room, then you're wrong. We might have particular expertise which we can use and leverage. But generally, our best work is done with others, you know, involved in the process.
Could be an idea you park for down the line too that pops up when you have the availability. Paul, we see a number of quotes circulating on social media showcasing something thought-provoking or inspiring from thought leaders across the globe and throughout time. If another quote, different from last time for you, was circulating on the topic of health, well-being or leadership, what would it say?
There's a bit of a, I'll see if you spot the similarity, because there's a couple of terms or words that will appear. True leadership is about fostering resilience, not just in our strategies or systems, but in the hearts and minds of those we lead. It's about creating environments where well-being is the foundation of success, where every challenge is met with compassion and courage.
I like that notion of resilience, because resilience implies that things are going to be a challenge, but we develop and strengthen ourselves through it to come out better than before, which is exactly what we need to do in a consultative process. This podcast is aptly titled Well-Led Schools, which is, of course, a play on words, as I talked about before, which reflects that those schools who lead with well-being in mind. What is one thing you think schools or school leaders can do to prioritize well-being that would make the biggest difference in their school?
I think it's such a complex area, and it takes real time and effort and investment to understand. So I think one highly effective way schools can prioritize well-being is by engaging external consultants to guide and enhance their well-being initiatives. Bringing in experts like yourself or me can provide a fresh perspective and specialized expertise that might not be available internally. That's the thing. You live and breathe and work every day in this space, and I work in the leadership space. So we invest a lot of time, you know, in this particular operational area. So principals can leverage the consultation or consultants very effectively. So firstly, school leaders should work through with consultants to conduct thorough well-being audits would be the first step. Those audits assess the current state of well-being, identifying strengths, but particularly areas for improvement. You know, people like yourself have expertise to analyse data, observe school dynamics, and gather input from all stakeholders through interviews or surveys. And when the once the audit's done, the consultant can facilitate the strategic planning sessions with school leadership teams to develop the interventions based on the findings. There might be new programs, policy adjustments, changes to school environment, but particularly those that enhance well-being. Consultants can provide ongoing support and training for staff. You know, that this is an area of expertise, generally not necessarily held by people internal. That could involve workshops, mental health awareness, could involve effective communication or stress management strategies or wellness and so on. Without labouring it too much, but I think the best thing, one of the things that I provide, and I know you do, is an accountability partner, you know, like a strategic advisor, critical friend, helping to keep the focus on well-being and ensuring that the school remains committed. So an external consultant can really keep the school on track, if you like. Left to internally, you know, you get so busy, but we've got our eye on one thing in that school and we're going to ensure that it continues. So, and then the final thing, of course, is we can help monitor the implementation of wellbeing strategies and suggest adjustments as needed. So critical friends like us, if you like, consultants or support personal strategic advisors, coaches, whatever term you want to use, it's all largely doing the same thing. We can sustain initiatives. We can sustain initiatives with a good partnership with the school.
And I think I'll add to that is that part of the work that I do with schools as well is to identify whether or not staff perceive that there are communication breakdowns, particularly in the area of involving staff in consultation and decision making. And if that is an area that's flagged by your staff, it does mean a little bit more work to be done, and it can sort of make parts of the process, I guess, more multi-layered. So I'm thinking of some of those schools who work with where this comes up as a key stressor for staff or part of their suggested wellbeing initiatives. And it does mean that then that vision setting process can take a little bit longer because we have to be really thorough and thoughtful around how we do that. When we ask for feedback on certain areas and then have to feed it back through, I actually find it does add a little bit more to that workload in terms of doing it, as opposed to those schools where they feel like that's done. They generally get the benefit of the doubt, don't they? And you probably would find it too in leadership improvement, that it does require a little bit more legwork in the beginning. But once we've established that trust and our staff see that it's there, they don't request as much of that work from us anymore, again, because the research shows that they give us the benefit of the doubt. They'll let us make mistakes and move on from them, whereas in cultures where maybe consultation needs a bit of work, there's a little bit more groundwork to be done, isn't there?
There is. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm finding even in vision setting processes with schools I'm working at where consultation is an area for focus, it feels like it takes a really long time because you've got to go to your leadership team, come back, refine, go to your staff again. But we just have to do that work in the early days.
Most things worth doing take time.
Yeah, you've touched on it already, but just to finish off, Paul, how can the audience work with you to enhance their leadership or consultation skills?
Thanks for the opportunity. I mean, the first area is leadership workshops and seminars, which could be one-off, but I prefer six-month or year-long programs. Customized services like doing, for example, an enrollment strategy, an audit of performance of staff organizational designs, for example. Then I do have a range of online courses and resources. So these are actual courses. Leadership team signs up. We have a balance of workshops and curated articles, coaching, Q&A sessions. And then my mentoring and coaching, that speaks for itself. And I do like speaking engagements and presentations, the one-offs, I really do. So, yeah, thanks for the opportunity to let people know what I do.
No. Listen, as in this wellbeing space, it's a beast, they always say, and I'll do some foundational level work with schools, and then there's definitely areas where I think going into some specific coaching or consulting work around that area would be really advantageous. And so for those school leaders or schools listening where they think, yeah, consultation and feedback and leadership are what we really need to dive into, Paul is somebody that I would most definitely recommend that people engage with. Paul, what are the best ways for listeners to engage with you?
Yeah, so look, pretty simple. LinkedIn is, well, I use that widely and extensively. Just Google my name, Paul Tees, and it'll come up, of course. I have a website, paultees.com. People go there to find out what I'm up to, but LinkedIn works. I do have a podcast. I love doing this one with you, and this is our second, but I do, with Brad Entwistle, we have the Applied School Leadership podcast, Applied School Leadership, probably about 18 episodes now. They're 15-minute, short, snappy ones on a particular theme. And then email me if you want to, pault05@gmail.com.
Wonderful. I'll add all of those into the show notes so that people can access. Paul, it's been absolutely amazing having you on today, and I loved all of your 3- and 4-part explanations for everything. Really great way to break it down for the listeners, and it'll be a resource that I direct many of my schools to listening to after we chat around consultation and communication throughout our partnership program. Thank you again. Have a wonderful day, and I'll look forward to chatting again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Adrienne. I look forward to another opportunity when you're ready to spend some time with me. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the World Led Schools podcast. The show notes for this episode, complete with information and links to connect with Paul, are available wherever you're listening to this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review if you haven't already. A little bit of kindness in your words goes a long way. Before you go, I want to remind our listeners that the Well-Led Schools Partnership Program is currently open to schools that are interested in investing their time and effort into improving the state of staff wellbeing and culture, beginning from next term and continuing on throughout the year. So there are lots of opportunities to consult with staff inside of the partnership program. This 12-month tailored professional development process brings school leaders and staff together so they can pinpoint challenges and stresses, co-create a vision for school wellbeing, agree on the joint responsibilities, and create a staff wellbeing action plan and framework for their school. Staff consultation is at the heart of our program, and we support leaders in creating a psychologically safe environment where their staff feel heard, valued, and respected. To learn more and apply, head to adriennehornby.com.au/school-partnerships and get all the details. Thanks so much for listening to Well-Led Schools. I look forward to connecting with you at adriennehornby.com.au. Here you can get in contact with me, learn more about my approach, and join my mailing list. I'm Adrienne Hornby. Thanks again for your time, and stay well.